From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Senator Gary Peters talks about the United States' escalating situation with Iran. He sits on the Armed Services and Homeland Security Committees. We'll ask him whether the nation should consider itself at war. Also, Michigan's Medicaid director joins us to discuss new work rules. Low-income and indigent people need to go to work or train to keep their health coverage. It's really not enough to just do the work.
If you are in compliance, we, the state, the Medicaid agency, need to know that.
One clinic in Traverse City checks in on how its clients are dealing. And we dive in on what's going wrong with the Lions.
What's right with this franchise? That's what their fans would ask.
Did you know Detroit teams have the worst combined record among peer cities? Why can't we have nice things? Those stories and more after the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, some people most in need of healthcare in Michigan run up against new federal work rules. It's going to be the difference between going to the doctor or going without. But first, over the weekend, U.S. foreign policy scrambled to recover from the lethal attack on Iran's General Qasem Soleimani, the head of an elite military wing active in Iraq, Syria, and other hotspots. The United States has interests in all of those places. The Trump administration said it was acting to save American lives. Senator Gary Peters, Democrat from Michigan, joins us today. He's the ranking Democrat on the Senate Homeland Security Committee and also serves on the Senate Armed Services Committee. And he's a veteran. Senator Peters, welcome.
April, good to be with you.
The United States rarely acts on this level, a leader of a sovereign nation. Was this killing justified?
Well, certainly Soleimani was a bad actor. I don't think there's any disagreement with that fact. He has blood on his hands and is responsible for the killing of many American men and women, service members. But certainly this represents an escalation in what we have seen happen in the Middle East. And I think the outstanding question right now is, was the president acting on an imminent threat, as he's claimed? I don't have information related to that. We have not been briefed according to that. However, a briefing will be given to members of the Armed Services Committee and other senators later this week in a classified setting. And I think we all come with some questions as to why this happened, and more importantly, what is the long-term strategic consequences of this? How was that thought out? And what sort of long-term strategy do we have in dealing with Iraq? What seems to have occurred is the chaos has now increased, and what we should be attempting to do is creating more stability in the Middle East. That certainly doesn't seem to be happening now, and we have questions that need to be answered.
Senator Tim Kaine has introduced a war powers resolution that would stop the action until such time as Congress might be able to get on board with a military effort with respect to Iran. We hear Senator Pelosi says the House will vote on a similar resolution soon. If the Senate voted today, do you think that that resolution would pass?
I think it's difficult given Republican senators who seem to basically just support the president in any activity that he is engaged in.
And are in the majority right now, yes.
And they have the majority. But it is important. Congress needs to reassert itself as the branch of government that has the power to declare war. You know, our framers were very clear that it's Congress that declares war, not the executive. And Congress is an important check. That's why it is unprecedented when you had President Trump launch this attack without even consulting with the leaders of Congress. And part of that consult, which is what all presidents do, is that we're stronger as a country when we are united and when we have Congress and the executive working together on a shared goal. That's how the strength of the United States. And when you do something without involving Congress, particularly given the inherent war power that is entrusted within the Congress by the Constitution, we have to reassert ourselves. And I think these resolutions are incredibly important.
Senator Peters, is the United States at war?
Well, certainly taking the kind of action that we've seen against a high-ranking government official is a significant escalation of the type of violence that we have been seeing recently in the Middle East. And I think what's really going to be critical is what happens in the days ahead in Iran. This is a difficult time for the United States to be taking this action and for the president to be taking this action, in my mind. There is no apparent diplomatic channels that are open between the United States and Iran. And whenever you have these types of acts, that can escalate very quickly if you don't have open lines of communication. We're also in a very strained period when it comes to our relationship with our allies. President Trump has driven a wedge between the United States and many of our allies. And again, we're stronger when we are united. That means acting with our allies. And then you have to add the third factor, and that's just the degree of skepticism that the American public has with the Trump administration and folks like myself who don't trust what I have heard until I see some facts and some evidence, and that has not been provided to us.
Whether or not the War Powers Resolution gets traction in Congress, this situation must be dealt with. What do you think should happen next between the U.S. and Iran?
Well, I think we have to make sure we're de-escalating. You can't have tit for tat and then and continue to escalate. Usually bad things happen. Mistakes can be made that can lead to very catastrophic consequences. It's very important for at least discussions to occur, and that's why it's so troubling, as I mentioned earlier, that there are no diplomatic channels that seem to be open. That should be happening, even if you have to go through a third party. You have to have folks talking to each other. What we're seeing instead is an escalation of the rhetoric from both sides, both from President Trump as well as some of the Iranian leaders. And the rhetoric could be potentially very dangerous, and I'm very concerned about that.
Senator Peters, thank you for your time today.
Great to be with you.
Senator Gary Peters, Democrat from Michigan. We will keep in touch with Michigan's elected officials and the delegation as the situation develops. While the nation's leaders debate the next move, the consequences are already being felt everywhere. And it may be that no one is watching these events more closely than Michigan's Persian American and Arab American communities as the conflict unfolds in Baghdad. We've invited Shireen Smalley to the studio today. She works at the National Network for Arab American Communities in Dearborn. Shireen, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me, April.
We should note the bright line here. You work for the network. Your family is Persian American, right?
That's right. Persian American on my mother's side, and my father grew up right here in Michigan, in Ann Arbor.
We should say you're just speaking for yourself.
That's right.
I want to ask you one of the questions that we just asked Senator Peters. Are we at war?
Well, I have to say, from the perspective of being an Iranian American in this country, it does feel like we are at war or at the brink of one. Just the events that have taken place in the last few days, not only the assassination of Soleimani on foreign soil, who's a major government official, plus the escalating rhetoric that has taken place over the last few days, including President Trump's two tweets in the past 48 hours about bombing cultural sites, in addition to the detainment and the detention of Iranian Americans trying to cross back into the United States from the Canadian border. All of these events do make it feel like we are at war.
Like you say, there's been some pretty explosive terminology used just over the past 48 hours. How does that land with you right now?
Well, for me and for others like me, for my family, for other Iranian Americans, it really feels isolating. It feels scary. The threat of war is scary. The threat of not being able to see family members or family members being in danger. Even, I would say, recently, family members not being able to access medicine because of economic sanctions, the degrading of the relationship between U.S. and Iran in the past 4 years, and in addition to the events that have taken place over this weekend, make it a very difficult time to be Iranian American in this country.
You have work experience helping people cope with the local dimensions of U.S. foreign affairs. When people who care about diplomatic relations and who care about the culture and what kind of conversation we're having here in the States, if they say to you that they want to make their voices heard, what kinds of things do you tell them?
Well, I wish I could tell local concerned citizens in this day and age that grassroots organizing was enough. But I think what we've been seeing recently is that these actions that have taken place, you know, most especially the assassination of General Soleimani, which was done even without the advice of top Pentagon officials, you know, these kinds of actions are taking place at the top levels of government. And so we really need to hold our communities, ourselves, and our members of Congress accountable and make sure that we are all striving for an anti-war solution, striving for diplomacy rather than escalating into more military conflict in the Middle East.
We heard Senator Peters talk about, in his view, the need for de-escalation, immediate de-escalation of the situation. Do you see a path toward unsinging this song?
Unfortunately, I don't. And that is just what has been so incomprehensible about the action that President Trump's administration took on Thursday to assassinate Soleimani. This isn't the sort of cat that you can put back in the bag. And unfortunately, those of us, even in the United States, who advocate for peace and diplomacy are going to be very hard-pressed to do so. Those in Iran who ordinarily would advocate for peace and diplomacy with the United States, it's going to be impossible for them to do that at this point.
We asked you here mostly because of your own relationship with this story as someone who has Persian-American family members. But professionally, you do talk to a lot of Arab Americans from a lot of different places around the world. What does the threat of increased violence in Iraq and, as you say, a much more involved war in the Middle East, what does that do to the community psyche?
Well, and again, I'm not able to speak on behalf of Access only because we're not a foreign policy organization, but the ramifications for Arab Americans in the United States are huge. Again, partly because this took place in Iraq, and there are now developing story out of Iraq about what this will mean for the country and the citizens of Iraq. But just generally speaking, when there's conflict, it really is the most vulnerable people, the most marginalized people, people of color, who suffer. And I have to say, it's just a really poor time for everyone. We're all hoping that this does not escalate into further conflict.
Shireen, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about this.
Thank you for having me, April.
Shireen Smalley, she works in Dearborn at the National Network for Arab American Communities. Shireen, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Shireen Smalley. We will have more from her tomorrow on Stateside. Please join us then. Coming up, people who rely on Medicaid for their health care must comply with new 2020 work rules. That's next on Here on Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Last week, Michigan put new requirements in place that may affect the health of hundreds of thousands of people on Medicaid. The new rules call for people under 63 who are on Medicaid to work or lose coverage. Kate Massey is the state Medicaid director with Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services. Kate, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Can you set the context for us with this? What was the intent of the new rules?
Sure. So the intent of the Healthy Michigan Plan was really to test whether or not tying Medicaid to a work requirement would lead to better outcomes and results for Michigan's Medicaid beneficiaries.
And these were enacted under Governor Snyder when Republicans were in control of the legislature, correct?
That's correct.
Right. The new rules state that non-exempt people between the ages of 19 and 62 have to report for 80 hours of work every month to continue to be eligible for Medicaid. How many people does that cover?
So there are about 670,000 individuals who are currently receiving services through Healthy Michigan Plan. We expect that about 240,000 individuals will need to comply with these new work requirements.
And what kind of work must they do to continue being eligible?
So there are a number of activities that people can engage in order to comply with the law. One is, of course, kind of what we consider to be traditional employment. But there are other activities, including looking for a job, being a student, such as pursuing a GED high school diploma or college diploma. And some of those education-related activities can also include job training and vocational training.
Now, this may be a little bit in the weeds, but obviously details can mean a lot in individual cases. What do people have to do to substantiate that they are following the rules?
So a lot of the rules really rely on the notion of self-attestation. So after individuals comply with the new requirements through any combination of the activities that I was just describing, they need to report either by phone, online, or in person to indicate that they have complied with those different activities. And then we also encourage people to save paperwork to the extent possible, such as W-2s or other indications of these type of activities, should they be required to prove their activity at the time that we engage in an audit.
And how long do people have to show the state that they are indeed making the effort and showing up for these work activities?
So the requirements indicate that beneficiaries need to report on a monthly basis. So, for example, if you engaged in 80 hours of activity in January, you have until the end of February to report those activities. And that needs to occur every single month for the duration of these requirements being in effect.
Kate, Medicaid users tend to be a population that experience real challenges. When Arkansas made a run at work rules for Medicaid back in 2018, a period of months went by, and some 18,000 people lost their coverage. Some admittedly because they got into jobs, but others because they didn't know about the change or were confused by the new rules, or maybe didn't have cell phones or had other problems navigating the system. What can Michigan do to make sure that hard-to-reach folks do not fall through the cracks?
Sure, and that's really important. When we look at Michigan's Medicaid program and the people who are subject to these requirements, we are concerned about the potential loss of coverage because by our estimates, if we were to look at states like Arkansas, which you just referenced, we think that up to 100,000 individuals might lose coverage, which we want to avoid at all costs. When we look at states like Arkansas or New Hampshire who have had a bit more experience in engaging in work requirements, there are several lessons learned that we incorporated into our Michigan implementation activities, and those include making sure that there are multiple ways for beneficiaries to report. So that's why I was emphasizing online, phone, or in-person reporting so that there are multiple modes of engagement. We also wanted to make sure that we were expanding our outreach and education activities. So, for example, through the fall, we had over 20 regional forums. Those were regional in-person throughout the state of Michigan, as well as virtual forums so that we could engage providers, health plans, and other stakeholders who will be interacting with our beneficiaries. And we also wanted to simplify our communications. So the letters that we've been sending out throughout the fall really boil down the call to action by using simple language, large font, bright colors, and very direct asks.
During the course of those forums, when you were asking the providers and people on the front lines, what can we do to make this work? What were some of the takeaways? You mentioned, you know, the bright signage, so to speak, would be really important.
Right. So what we've been doing throughout the fall is really making sure that we hit the messaging at the appropriate level. And so through those regional forums, what we found was that people were hungry for educational materials. So on our website, for example, we make available different types of posters, booklets designed for beneficiaries and whatnot that really kind of explain these pretty complex requirements. And those educational materials were developed in conjunction with different partners who are really attuned to what we call behaviorally informed design, so that we really take a look at how the beneficiary is internalizing and interpreting the message. The other thing that we've done is we've actually, through different focus group testing, have kind of taken all of these really important messages and make sure that people understand what we're trying to communicate.
Let's say someone gets a job and maybe even gets a job and moves off Medicaid. People who work in low-wage jobs can sometimes experience a lot of mobility. If you lose a job, can you then start over from square one with the work rules, or is the clock still running from your last period of unemployment?
So just to make sure I'm kind of tracking the conversation correctly, because there are different ways to comply with the work requirements, employment is not the only one. So you are essentially on a continuous clock to the extent that you are eligible for Medicaid via the Healthy Michigan plan. So if it's employment, that's one way to comply. If you lose your employment, you technically still are on the clock and you can engage in looking for a job or, like I said before, kind of going through training or kind of educational pursuits in order to make sure that you maintain your coverage.
Right. And you just need to do the diligence with respect to those other alternative activities to show that you're making an effort.
That's right.
If someone stands to lose their Medicaid coverage, I imagine some lack of care might cause real problems for people's health, maybe even be life-threatening, yes?
We are very concerned, yes, that any type of disruption in coverage could risk beneficiary outcomes.
Is there anything in place either at the provider level or at the state level to try to catch people who are falling through the cracks?
Well, we're partnering with our stakeholders as well as our partner health plans to make sure that that situation is avoided. So we are coordinating by sharing data about people who are at risk of losing coverage, exactly who those beneficiaries are, so that we can try to reach out to them to prevent that situation from occurring.
Aren't some people on Medicaid already working?
Yes.
They would already be covered, right? They would not lose their coverage as long as the salary requirements were not changing.
Well, and as long as they report, right? That's a key component to the work requirements rules, which is if you are in compliance, we, the state, the Medicaid agency, need to know that. So they need to continue to report their good behavior through the monthly reporting.
The leaders who put these work requirements into play had several different outcomes in mind, and some of them might have been behavioral. Some of them might have been to stave off the use of emergency rooms when primary care is really what's going to keep health costs down and lead to better outcomes. Might the state save money as the result of the work requirements?
So we are very interested in what the results of the work requirements will be, what the impact is to access, to coverage, and what type of results will materialize. What we are doing is partnering with the University of Michigan to evaluate what the implications of work requirements will be, to see if that scenario that you've just described actually comes to fruition.
Right now, there's a trio of nonprofits in a lawsuit with the U.S. government claiming that the work rules aren't appropriate and go against the mission of Medicaid. And there's a separate lawsuit in federal court in Michigan also challenging the rules on behalf of plaintiffs who are on Medicaid. Is there any reason for people to think that they should wait to see what comes out of those court cases?
So we are obviously actively tracking the results of those court cases. Until the courts have had a chance to evaluate the case, there's been no suspension of the work requirements that's been issued. And so we are in a go-forward approach. I will say that both Governor Whitmer and Director Gordon have asked the legislature for a delay as a way to make sure that there's continuous coverage, as well as to avoid wasting taxpayer dollars on implementation of a program that may be suspended. But the legislature has deferred on that option.
Well, Kate, is there anyone on Medicaid right now who does not have to follow the new work rules?
Yeah, there's one element that I think is really key for work requirements, and that is that there is a list of exemption categories for people who are subject to these requirements that I think is really important to highlight. There are actually 12 categories of exemptions. I won't go through them all, but they are available for viewing on our website, which is at michigan.gov/healthyMI plan. But if individuals are, for example, pregnant, taking care of a person with a disability or a child under the age of 6, if they're a full-time student, or if they're medically frail, which is to say that they face challenges to complying with the rules, they can pursue an exemption at any time and then be removed or excused from these reporting requirements that we just reviewed this afternoon.
Well, Kate, thank you very much for talking with us about this today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Kate Massey is State Medicaid Director for Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services. We wanted to know more about how the work rules are playing out at ground level. Arlene Brennan is the CEO of the Traverse Health Clinic in Traverse City, and she's with us today on Stateside. Arlene, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Can you tell us how many people the clinic serves?
About 3,900 each year.
And of those, do you have an idea of how many will need to pay attention to the new work rules for Medicaid?
Yes, we just checked our enrollment data, and about 1,000. So probably right about 26%.
What's on your mind as you consider how your clients will come to terms with complying with these rules?
Well, a lot of unknowns, but we are doing as much as we can to help make people aware of these changes that are coming up, and for us to be as prepared as we can be to assist them.
Can you give us a little context for maybe why some of these folks might be on Medicaid, or what kinds of issues might have stood in the way of work for them in the past? The ones who do not currently have a job, that is.
Well, I think for some people, it could be job skills and a history of work in the past. We have many people who have low-paying jobs, and I think for them, this will be no issue, but I think it's just the process of trying to get people aware and perhaps making them want to be able to get a job if they don't have them. For some people, if there were medical reasons, for instance, we take care of a lot of people with diabetes. And if diabetes has been out of control, it's hard for them to hold down a job, attend regularly, or other chronic diseases, even things like obesity, challenges of movement and getting around. For some, it could be transportation issues, don't have a car, or their car is unreliable, a lot of social relations or a lot of social issues that can affect it as well.
Can you give us an example?
Well, I think some of it could be taking care of children, or, for instance, I can think of one gentleman right now who can't work regularly and is concerned that he's going to be affected because a friend of his who has two children, these are not his biologic kids, was evicted, couldn't pay her rent, so she and her kids moved in with him. And because she has a job, the job he had to be cut down so one of them could take care of the little kids.
So it's kind of a non-traditional arrangement.
Oh, absolutely. There are many situations like that that occur with the people we serve.
We know that there is an exception for people who are taking care of kids, but do you know if that could apply if the children are not your biological sons and daughters?
That I don't know, and I can't remember the age, the cutoff age of the young child. I'm thinking maybe 6 years, but one of these children is in school. So someone has to be there when the bus brings them back. Someone has to be at home. So it makes it a real challenge.
It seems like that might be an issue for folks taking care of their extended family's kids as well.
Right. And very truthfully, I don't know the details about that.
Yeah. Arlene, what's been challenging about getting the word out to folks?
I think it's just the magnitude, the large number of people who will be affected. And very often, people are just addressing the crisis of the day and, kind of wait for the letters to arrive and wait to see what might happen. We've been talking with our patients about it for a long time. My partner here, Mai, just looked, and it says parent of child under age 6. So if you're not a parent, but you're in a situation like this gentleman is, the exception probably doesn't apply.
We've been talking about the clinic's clients, the folks you work with every day, but are there ways in which the new Medicaid rules might affect the clinic itself and your staff?
Oh, sure. First of all, it's the access issue. People who come here for care know that we will work with them on finances, and we, of course, never turn anybody away based on inability to pay. But when some change like that comes up, it will definitely make an impact on someone coming in for a follow-up appointment, for a follow-up visit. And the other thing is medications. The Healthy Michigan Plan provides prescription coverage. So if you lose that, what do you do? And insulins, for example, are extremely expensive. So the ramifications of it are huge. And access to other types of services. If someone needs to see a specialist, the ability to get reimbursed, it's a huge snowball effect.
Well, thank you for giving us a little bit closer view of this. We appreciate it very much.
Well, you're very welcome.
Arlene Brennan is the CEO of the Traverse Health Clinic in Traverse City. After the break, the long, dark winter facing Lions, Pistons, and Red Wings fans.
With the Lions, it was like, finally, we have a guy who's going to be ahead of the curve, who's going to be someone who's innovative, and that isn't working out either.
Two sports columnists talk about how they cover losing seasons. Did I say losing? I meant apocalyptic. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Yesterday, the defending Super Bowl champs, the New England Patriots, led by Michigan alum Tom Brady, lost in the playoffs. Sad day for Brady, maybe, but even worse for Lions fans, who are once again left out of playoff joy. This is nothing new for Detroit. Remember Thanksgiving, when the Detroit Lions did what the Lions do? Just a couple of minutes to spare, and they lost the lead they had held all game against the Chicago Bears.
He's coming with pressure, and here's one aired out downfield and picked off. Taking a seat, Eddie Jackson.
It's not as if the Lions don't have plenty of company. Pistons owner Tom Gorris just acknowledged that the losing organization has a lot of rebuilding to do. Trade talks are afoot. And the Tigers? Let's just say owner Chris Illich also knows rebuilding is in the cards.
What I've learned in professional sports is that you need an awful lot of things to go right. To predict a time frame, you're asking the wrong guy.
With us today are John Neo, a sports columnist for the Detroit News, and Matt Shook, who also writes for the Detroit News and hosts the podcast Locked on Pistons. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
We'd love to hear how you're getting through these difficult times. You can drop a note on our Facebook page. You can also hit us on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Well, let's start with what Chris Illich said, that it just takes time to rebuild. I feel like the question on everybody's minds is, how long? How long should it take for at least some of these teams to contend for a championship or even solid playoff performance again?
Well, I think the short answer is longer than anybody would like to understand or believe in this town. It's already been a few years now of really the darkest sort of stretch with all four teams losing, and the prospects aren't real great for anything to turn around immediately on any of those fronts. And so I think that's dawned on fans here in Detroit, and now as they look and they listen to some of these billionaire owners tell them to be patient, it's a little hard to be patient right now.
And it used to be easier because at least you had some teams right. That were pretty good. The Red Wings have been good for so long, and the Tigers had good stretches, but now to have all four of them rough like this is pretty daunting.
I think that brings us to the Lions. I mean, they haven't won a championship since 1957.
I heard that.
And the last time they won a playoff game, I think I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
What is wrong with this franchise?
What's right with this franchise? That's what their fans would ask you. And they've sort of always been compared to the other franchises in this town in a negative light because they were the one team that couldn't win, couldn't get over the top, couldn't figure it out. Now they've got company. It does not change the fact that they haven't built any goodwill over the last half century. And I think that's where the fans, they get tired of the same rinse and repeat cycle of new coach, new GM, start all over again with some hope, do it all over again in 4 years. And it feels like, especially this fall, feels like that's almost approaching if not this winter, next year. And I think everybody's just sort of dreading that, you know, back to square one feeling that that is pretty common with this franchise.
Yeah, I think they've failed on kind of all different fronts over the last 50, 60 years, and they've tried this and tried that and been too loyal to certain people in the organization. And then, like John said, moved too quickly between other people over time. And like we said, now it's such a rough season that you probably want to look at changing everything again, and it's not a pretty thing for fans.
Again.
And the part of the problem, too, for the Lions, this current regime, they both came in, the general manager, Bob Quinn, and the head coach, Matt Patricia, staggered. They came in a couple years apart, but they both came in from the Patriots organization. So this was, from a Lions fan's perspective, okay, finally we've found a couple of guys who know how to win. They're going to finally get this on track. Well, that hasn't happened yet. And the problem is they, when they did hire Matt Patricia as head coach 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago now, the notion was, well, it was a 9-7 team. It was a winning, quote unquote, team before he got here, and that wasn't good enough. We're going to win championships was sort of the message that was delivered to the fans. And since then, they've proceeded to go backwards. And whether that's by design, I don't think that's by design, but whether the changing of the roster and the philosophy has led to this, the fans aren't going to be patient to hear that out.
And I think that with Matt Patricia, what's more frustrating is that he was kind of billed as this guy who was ahead of the curve, as kind of an innovator, whereas we look at the other franchises, it's a little bit more explainable with the Tigers and Red Wings. They were just trying to hold on for so long and just throwing money at the problem while Mike Ilitch was at the end of his life. And with the Lions, it was like, finally, we have a guy who's going to be ahead of the curve, who's going to be someone who's innovative, and that isn't working out either.
You start to see fans claiming online that they're Lions-free. Is that reflected at all in ticket sales? What do you see happening within the seats?
Slightly. I think it's more laughable than realistic. I mean, it's been 60 years, and the stadium is still relatively full every Sunday. But no, the last couple of years, they have dropped off, you know, 1,500 attendance per game the last couple of years. This year's similar drop. So I think fans have taken notice. And a few weeks ago, Dallas Cowboys were in town, and it was noticeable. You had to be paying attention to the game to know who was doing what, because the cheers were just as loud for the Cowboys as they were for the Lions. And I think that was embarrassing, probably, for the franchise and for ownership. Maybe not enough to make a huge change, drastic change this offseason, but it was noticeable.
Yeah, and I think that just from writing stories and being at the facility a couple times a week with Justin Rogers with the Detroit News, it's a, before, you know, you got training camp, you got the first half of the season, they played well for 3 or 4 weeks. You're busting out a bunch of stories because the content demand is so high. And now you go out there and it's like, what are we going to write about? You know, I mean, it's the end of the season. You're looking for some positives to possibly write about. You're looking to encapsulate the problems and the negatives, and you're kind of writing the same stuff week after week. So it makes jobs tough for us, for sure.
Well, Matt, I feel like I'm starting to see writers around town really reaching. I mean, one headline, the favorite breakfast foods of the players that you see every Sunday. I mean, what do you do to come up with more to say in the situation?
Yeah,
I mean, at least where the Lions are concerned.
Yeah, you do kind of find some offbeat stuff like that. But you also kind of notice, and I've grew up here myself and moved back here about a year and a half ago. And so I've been reading John and reading, you know, all the columnists, Mitch Albom, going back all these years, and it's like you kind of see the same cycle of columns being kind of rewritten from the past couple decades or so of, you know, maybe we should boycott the Thanksgiving game. Maybe we should do a fan, you know, staging a demonstration or something like that. And I'm like, I remember when they did that 20 years ago, and it kind of worked a little bit with the Matt Millen era and everything. But it's like, after a while, you wonder if people still have the energy. And yes, there's always going to be the diehards, the people that live and die with it every Sunday, but I wonder if there's a middle group of Lions, you know, casual fans that are just going to be turned off, especially someone my age in your late 30s who really hasn't seen any kind of real success over the past couple decades. You just wonder what the lifespan is and if there's kind of a limit to the amount of abuse that people can take every Sunday with that organization.
Speaking of someone who's still a little PTSD from the Browns franchise reboot, I mean, I understand what this means in the context of one team, but we're really looking at something bigger here. Last fall, Will Birchfield did a breakdown for 97.1 The Ticket, tallying wins and losses across Detroit's four professional sports teams. And at that point, he found the teams having a combined record, the Tigers, the Wings, the Pistons, and the Lions, brace yourself, 346, 543, and 1.
Not good.
That puts Detroit last among 13 metro areas that have four major sports teams. I mean, wow.
Yeah, and the only other city that has four teams that's even close to that bad in this last few year stretch is Miami, and I think we can all agree they have some other things that probably keep them occupied
right.
other than sports this time of year. So, no, it's and of those teams, I mean, that's the problem. It's, like we said, they're all bad at once. I think what the anger comes from in different places for each organization, too. I mean, the Tigers, they were so good for a stretch here not that long ago, but they never won the World Series, and I think that drives fans crazy because the owner had spent tons of money, $200 million payrolls, and they never got to the finish line. They never got the championship parade, and now they're seeing it all torn down, and they're wondering why, or they're wondering where was our payoff. And the flip side is the Red Wings were so good for so long, 25-year straight playoff streak. Now they're so bad. They are by far the worst team in the league this year, and it's just jarring for those fans who used to go expecting to see a win every night, not just star, you know, not just a win, but also superstar players and a superstar lineup. They don't see that anymore. So there's different reasons for different fan bases here, individual teams to be angry, but when you put it all together, it is frustrating.
Yeah, and I think the one thing that I'll be a little bit of Mr. Brightside here, I think the 1970s were just as bad, mm-hmm. and this before my time, but going back and, you know, knowing about the histories of these teams, I think that the late 70s might be a period that is kind of congruous to what's going on right here, just nothing going on. But the good news was that when the early 80s came, there were some superstar players that came into Detroit that really kind of turned things up a little bit.
I don't know that fans really have any choice. I mean, can they do no. anything but support the teams that they've followed all this time?
No, for sure. Look, Detroit is by, you know, easily one of the best sports cities in the country. You know, you've got your New York and Boston and Chicago, and Detroit is right up there in terms of just the pure passion for sports all across the board. They don't have a choice. They can choose to be Lions free if they want, but they're just kidding themselves in most cases. They're still going to watch. They're still going to maybe not buy tickets. And that's where you start to see major changes happen with some of these teams is when the seats do look empty to the owner up in the suite, they notice that. They notice it in their pocketbook. They notice it certainly in visual evidence. And I think we'll see some decisions made here in the coming, you know, months that may reflect that.
Yeah, I think the NBA that I follow, you know, day in and day out is the one sport where you can kind of ignore the Pistons like a lot of people do around here mm-hmm. and still be a big fan of the NBA. You can follow your favorite players as they change teams every couple years. The national television, the NBA League Pass. I think that's maybe the one sport that you can kind of avoid the local team if you want to and be a fan of LeBron James and be a fan of Giannis Antetokounmpo. And I think that's what a lot of young fans are doing around here too.
As they play their Xbox.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's exactly true. No, I can speak from, I've got a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old at home that will vouch for that.
Mm-hmm. It's tempting to lump Michigan football in with this discussion, but it's worth noting that the Wolverines really aren't doing that badly. They might get, you know, the problem is Jim Harbaugh's troubles with a certain school to the south. Mm-hmm. Big Ten football becoming so comically lopsided, where does that leave Michigan and Michigan State with Ohio State so relentlessly dominant?
Yeah, and that's sort of been the respite for fans, you know, the true sports fans around here the college sports scene has been thriving still. Both basketball teams, you know, making Final Four runs and Big Ten title runs, and both football teams having a lot of success. But you mentioned it, Jim Harbaugh, obviously Michigan hasn't beaten Ohio State in what seems like an eternity. He was brought in as hailed as a bit of a savior, and it hasn't quite happened the way people envisioned. And then in the same time, Michigan State, which was riding high there 4 or 5 years ago, now has fallen in back almost to where they were before Mark D'Antonio got there 13 years ago. And so, yeah, this fall, you didn't get much relief in terms of pain and suffering if you were a college football fan around here either.
Yeah.
But the college basketball fans are kind of the one beacon of hope right now. Michigan State came in as the number one team in the country. Some stumbles early, but it's Tom Izzo, so you got to believe they're going to be
back and going strong in March, and obviously Michigan basketball with the amazing start that they've had. A couple of things to kind of get us through the winter here, I guess, with those programs.
I want to talk more about basketball, but do you see Jim Harbaugh at risk in his job in 2020?
I do not, no. He has done, by and large, everything they wanted him to do except beat Ohio State at this point, because the stadium is full, the donors are gladly giving money again, all of those things. Even now, it's only been 4-5 years since he returned, but people forgot how bad and dreary it was. I mean, when we talk about empty seats, it was really getting unusually empty at Michigan Stadium before he got there, and they've gotten back to being, look, they're not the Big Ten champion. That's what he was ultimately brought back to do, but they're back to being a contender again, and I think that's good enough for a lot of Michigan fans for now.
How about Mark D'Antonio? Beloved, but losing.
Yeah, he's had so much success in the past that I think it's kind of his call at this point. But at some point, you wonder if the things that stack up, the losing season this year, barely a winning season, I guess, and then the things that are going on off the field, you just wonder if that wears on him enough to where he doesn't want to deal with it anymore and can kind of go out relatively on top as opposed to what might come over these next year or two. There's going to be recruiting issues because everyone's going to have uncertainty about the program right now. So it's at this point, I still believe it's his decision. Obviously, everything that's going on with Michigan State in terms of the leadership at the university and the athletic department doesn't suggest that there's going to be enough of a power situation to where D'Antonio is told that he's got to go. So I think it's up to him, but that would not shock me if he decides that this is too much to deal with right now, and maybe it's a time to turn it over to someone else. But I think it's going to be up to him.
Yeah. Matt, you sent out a tweet last year suggesting that the truth is that Michigan just wants to see a winning team, any winning team in a sport. During these dark ages, you didn't know that living your dream as a Detroit sports writer would be so dark. Do we need to send you a sun lamp or something here?
That would be great.
We're worried.
Yeah, that would be great.
Do a safety check. Okay.
Yeah, I moved back home and expected to cover the World Series and the NBA Championship and Stanley Cup Finals, and here we are thinking about what to write about with the Lions today, and we're going to figure it out.
Gentlemen, thank you both very much for helping us through this difficult time.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot.
Matt Shook is the host of Locked On Pistons and writes for the Detroit News. And John Neo is a sports columnist for the Detroit News. If you are ready to bet against the Lions, you are just about to get your shot. Over the holidays, Governor Gretchen Whitmer signed the bill that will allow sports betting and online gambling first at casinos in Detroit, with online options following later. The timeline is still uncertain as state regulators still have to work out licensing rules. Rick Pluta is Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief. He joins us today, Rick.
Hi.
Got that fantasy team ready to go?
I mean, just about any betting I do is on a fantasy team, and I'll still mess it up.
Right. So in other places, the online betting market trends toward a few major brands controlling a lot of the action. There are some huge players in the fields of online gaming who tend to lock in exclusive deals with leagues and other kinds of advantages. Who stands to benefit as Michigan ramps up its plan for sports betting and online gambling?
I know that there are big players, no pun intended in this case, that are lined up to get into the business, that there are companies that do this in something like 20 other states. But you're getting a little beyond my area of expertise there, that the next step is the Michigan Gaming Control Board is going to come up with rules. They don't know exactly how long that's going to take. But the goal is to have that in place by March Madness, when the commercial players that you're talking about are probably going to engage very, very quickly.
I see an Australian company has already signed a deal with the Lac-Vieux des Herbes Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians to operate the tribe sportsbook. So maybe what we'll see is local entities partnering with some of the global players?
Well, in Michigan, the knowledgeable players, the experienced players, are the tribal casinos that have been allowed to do this now for decades.
Like you said, the hope is to get things rolling as soon as March. Michigan is the 20th state to get into this and legalizing sports betting. Have you seen any signs about what some of the priorities might be about as this structure takes place? I mean, I know the governor was concerned about schools taking a hit. Do we know yet where the taxes levied for online gambling might end up directed?
Well, some of it is to make up for what may be lost revenue, you know, to the lottery. Part of it, I think it's roughly $4 million is going to go to fund a problem gamblers program. And so those are kind of the two, you know, main ones. Plus, obviously, the costs, you know, the state is supposed to be reimbursed for the costs of regulating, you know, inspecting, things like that.
Rick, thanks very much.
Oh, a pleasure.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. And I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.